Welcome to Muffly Auto, a Harry Potter podcast where we fill your ears to prevent you from hearing nearby conversations. I'm Josh.
And I'm Blake, and today we look at unicorns from a distance as we continue our journey through Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire and come now to the 24th chapter, Rita Skeeter's Scoop. So Josh, we have a magical creature's teacher, a substitute teacher, I believe they refer, whereas I think here in New Zealand we call them relievers. Like your school, did they call them like relievers or substitute teachers, or is that more in a North American thing?
We called them that. So growing up, we definitely had substitute teachers. We called them officially, I think they were called teachers on call, or TOC.
Oh, wow.
We'd okay. call them subs, substitutes, subs, et cetera. Yeah. But I've done some substitute teaching or some relief teaching in New Zealand, and you've never been called a sub.
Okay, cool. Because I just remember different readings about, this chapter, about different things about, Professor Grubbly Punk. You obviously get a little bit of both because a lot of people from North America will be putting their input in, and then obviously sort of British English putting their thoughts in. And so, from reliever, but I think I saw more often or not, Professor Grubbly Plank was, like a substitute teacher. And she seems like a pretty good one that sometimes substitutes have like a multiple different schools, right? That they go to. We never really get like a roster of substitute teachers that are permanent to Hogwarts. And it just seems like she's just lives in the village maybe. And she is just, helping out the school a little.
Yeah. I always ended up feeling quite sad for Professor Grubbly Plank. I don't know about you. Maybe I'm being overly sensitive, but obviously we're supposed to feel excited when Hagrid comes back, but I just can't help but feeling that the most qualified person for the job isn't able to get it. And thinking to myself, what on earth is she supposed to do with her life? Like, there's only one care of magical creatures job at Hogwarts. There's only one magical school in the country. Poor Professor Grubbly Plank.
I know. I wonder if it's like more just she's come out of retirement and she's, I feel like does she mention in this chapter or in another like that she's doing this as a favor to Dumbledore? I might be getting confused.
I think that's in the next book when Hagrid's away on his journey. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Just as a favor to Dumbledore. So I'm like, part of me thinks like, is this just a favor? Is this just like I'm retired, but sure. Okay. Yeah. I'll manage those classes just till Hagrid gets back. Cause it seems like Dumbledore's pretty determined on getting Hagrid back that, he might have just talked to Grubbly Plank because it was just like, just for short term, just whilst our current teacher's, working through a few life issues. And it seems like a pretty easy thing that he just sort of would say. And then Hagrid obviously is thinking, I'm never going back to teach again. But like Dumbledore knows, he knows. But I am fascinated, and it's maybe jumping the gun, but I am fascinated by the few comments surrounding her teaching and that they all loved it. And, it was a proper magical creature, and you kind of feel bad for Hagrid, but you're like, it does sound like an awesome lesson, although maybe more awesome for the ladies, because as I kind of alluded to, the guys kind of can't really get too close to a unicorn. They prefer sort of the female's touch.
Yeah, no, it is a bit of a rough class for the gentlemen. And you do almost wonder how it's supposed to work with Hagrid, because he seems to be, I guess what, even though I just said Professor Grubbly Plank seems more qualified, I do feel like Hagrid has one of the most natural touches with animals and fantastic beasts out of anybody. And so it seems like he's able to do well with the unicorns, even despite his maleness and his giantness as well. Yes. Right? Like, it's not just the fact that he's a male, but he's also a giant.
No, he just thinks they're boring. They're just like not.
Yeah, that's right. That's which is hilarious.
Which is nuts, because you're like, it's a unicorn, but it's like, ugh, it has no like, flaws or characteristics that make it interesting, it's not dangerous. And you're like, well, okay, just, some of these students are still pretty young, Hagrid,
That's right.
Yeah, we all might teach one aspect of our subject that we, maybe don't like as much, or it's a bit more difficult, and so, come on, Hagrid.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, and I feel like you come away from these books, especially books 4 and 5, thinking to yourself that Hagrid has a really interesting teaching philosophy, because we don't see the subject in the hands of anyone else until Grubbly Plank. And so we're like, maybe Care of Magical Creatures is this like wild, carefree area where anything goes. And it's like, well, probably just Hagrid's.
Yeah, I think there needs to be a Care for Magical Creatures course, which Grubbly Plank takes. And then there is a Dangerous Beasts course. An elective that Hagrid runs. And it's just for, only a select amount of students that choose to take that extreme subject where, maybe they go around places, Dumbledore creates a whole bunch of portkeys for them. They go around to the dragons. They go around to, places this where there might be other monsters. And it's only for, certain students. So people like Malfoy would not be allowed to enter, because obviously they have shown in the past that they do not mesh well with Hagrid and then they will just get killed. But for people like, it would be seen as a class where you're like, since you're opting into it as like an elective, like you said, I think people would really like dig that if it was like, all right, we're going to go study dragons. And you're like, whoa, okay. So it would be quite a cool elective, maybe on the side of Care of Magical Creatures. And, maybe even if it's just for a certain amount of weeks, like it's like Hagrid takes them on this epic kind of across the world portkey adventure that just goes to all these different locations of magical beasts. I think we're onto something there.
I think so, Blake. This sounds great. And one of the things I think is really great about it is that the idea, I think, of travel is really underestimated when you look at like the Hogwarts schooling. Like for how easy it is to travel for wizards, whether
where are their school trips?
Can't we use
is that what you mean?
More often? Pardon?
Is that what you mean? Like, where are their school trips?
Where are their school trips? Yeah. Think of portkeys and thestrals and, even a short broom ride they don't even do at any time. It's like, yeah, they never travel anywhere. And I feel like you could easily go down to like other parts of Europe in an afternoon.
Maybe they just don't trust the young witches and wizards to
which
to
is keep fair enough. Both of us being teachers, yeah,
yeah, that's so true. Yep. So that's definitely something that I feel like they would I would love to see a bit more of is some kind of outside adventure, even if it's to like there's no even trip to like another magical school as such, like an exchange less proportion than the whole tournament that we see, the Triwizard Tournament. But like, why not all take a trip to the Ministry of Magic together? Why not take a trip to the States and go over to see, their Ministry of Magic? And, like, it's kind of like, I know that certain groups are quite secretive, but there's got to be aspects of each other's countries and creatures and things that you could potentially try and do to foster those relationships. But yeah, I mean, maybe everybody's just happy with chilling at Hogwarts and chilling with the giant squid in the lake, and that's their excitement. But definitely a magical beast course or elective from Care of Magical Creatures would be a pretty sweet thing. I'd probably take that.
Yeah, I'd just maybe picture like a guest teaching by Charlie Weasley sometime, How good would that be?
I think that would be pretty sweet. Like get in these people who are like really knowledgeable about that specific thing. And then you're also exposing people to the different jobs that are out there as well.
Well, that's what I was thinking about. Like, I understand not taking first years to the Ministry of Magic, but it seems like that year 6 and 7 students would leave Hogwarts, depending on their family, not really knowing what's out there other than a job at Hogwarts. Think of someone like Harry, if he didn't have a friend like Ron or Hermione.
Exactly.
If Hermione didn't read all these books, how would she know about like wizarding law and things like that? Like,
or like a person who uses runes in the field, or like, what was a spell breaker or something, a curse breaker in Egypt, and all these sorts of things. Like, I think, you know, you need to go to the ministry, have those trips, because if you someone who just, you know, is not even connected in with the Ministry of Magic, then you don't know what's there at the Ministry of Magic, you know, whereas at least say Ron does have his dad and he could be like, what other departments are there, dad? What are the blah, blah, blah? And then that information for him. But it does seem like it's a little bit of a area lacking at Hogwarts where it's like looking at future, you know, future lessons, future plans. Maybe that's just because maybe that's all talked about in the final year of Hogwarts. And
we don't see that.
We miss that. They're just a little bit preoccupied with a whole Wizarding World war. So, yeah.
When war is taking place, those things do tend to be pushed to the sidelines, I should say, which is fair enough.
Yeah, because depending on if Voldemort win, I feel like there'd be a few job positions that would be open some vacancies.
And some also closed.
And some closed, departments closed.
Probably not needing Muggle relations with Voldemort.
Probably not. Probably not. If you know, Arthur Weasley isn't dead already in this new world order from Voldemort, I'm pretty sure his job is now ended. So they'll need to start looking for a new one. But we definitely digressed with that one. Josh, do you want to jump into the chapter summary?
I think it was worthwhile. It was worthwhile.
Definitely.
Always worthwhile criticizing the education system of Hogwarts, right? Everyone in Hogwarts is slow to rise after the exciting events of the previous evening. Hermione and Ron are civil towards one another, but Harry notes that their interactions are somewhat stilted and formal. When Ron and Harry tell Hermione about what they have overheard about Hagrid's background, she is neither surprised nor alarmed that he is half-giant. Now that the school holidays are over, Harry begins to feel the pressure of the second task. Even though he has not cracked the egg, he's unwilling to follow Cedric's advice, which he deems useless, because of Cedric's recent relationship with Cho Chang. When the students arrive at their first Care of Magical Creatures class, there is a visiting witch named Professor Grubbly Plank. She refuses to answer any questions about Hagrid's whereabouts, but instead begins an exemplary lesson on unicorns. Malfoy mocks Hagrid and Harry by extension by showing him the Rita Skeeter article about Hagrid's giantess mother and his careless teaching practices. The trio try and persuade Hagrid to talk to them, but they receive no answer from his hut. His absence continues for a week without changing. During the Hogsmeade weekend, the trio, including Harry, much to Hermione's displeasure, are in the Three Broomsticks when Ludo Bagman makes an offer to help Harry to win the tournament. Harry refuses the offer and Ludo rushes off, avoiding a conversation with Fred and George. Rita Skeeter enters the pub and Harry confronts her about the article she has written. Skeeter defends the rights of the public to know the truth. Later that night, the trio return to Hagrid's hut and make it clear that they will not leave without seeing him. As Hermione pounds on the door, the headmaster opens it and, while at first sheepish, Hermione continues to tell Hagrid how ridiculous he is being. Dumbledore announces that he has refused to accept Hagrid's resignation and expects him to return to work. The three students then sit with Hagrid and hear about his childhood, and Harry fibs about how far along he is with the next clue. Having to lie to Hagrid forces him to acknowledge that he needs to use Cedric's clue.
Pride. Pride, pride, pride. It just comes before, you know, Harry in that moment leading up being like, no, you know, Cedric's just taking the mickey out of me. I won't. But I think he finally realizes after this chapter's done, like there's a lot of people counting on him. There's a lot of people riding, you know, just on the fact that, hey, Harry could win this. And that would bring a lot of hope to people. And then, you know, after this very raw moment with Hagrid, you know, it sets in stone really. Okay. I've got to do it. I've got to, you know, all avenues. I've got to test because, you know, I can't keep lying to these people who care for me, you know. And he's like, Hagrid's so happy that like Harry's doing well and so he can't let them down. So,
yeah, well, and like one of the things I find so interesting is like I feel like everything we're told about Cedric Diggory, how beloved he is at Hogwarts and especially by his house, how kind he seems, how good he is at most things, right? Like he's quite a good Quidditch player, excellent student, obviously. I just feel like the amount of time Harry spends thinking about Cedric is so much more than the amount of time Cedric spends thinking about Harry.
Yeah, it's I'm going to say that one's a little bit one-sided. And Harry gives way more thought to that compared to Harry. And so really, I almost feel like Harry's not even on Cedric's radar.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, and so it's just kind of like, just listen to his clue. Like, he helped you, and maybe that's just Cedric's way. Like, he doesn't give a clear cut. Go take a bath and listen to the egg under the water. Like, maybe he thinks there needs to be some level of, like, Harry understood it for himself. I don't want to be accused here as cheating. Maybe.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think the other thing with that, Blake, is that when you think about who Cedric is and what he's kind of like, one of the things that's really interesting is he might be one of the very few people in Hogwarts who thinks about Harry this little, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah,
Harry's a pretty well-known person, an envied person by some, a hated person by others. Cedric, you know, beats him in Quidditch. Cedric is doing just fine in his life without him. Cedric's got the girl. Cedric doesn't need to think about Harry, which is so rare.
No. Yeah. No, that's like, that would actually make, I feel like, Cedric a really good friend, I think, for Harry, if they were in the same year level. It's obviously
great
a little
point.
Bit different. And maybe
that's the friendship that we didn't know we needed right there.
Yeah, exactly. Because I just feel like Cedric would just be such a down-to-earth person, not be plagued with that jealousy like Ron is, and be able to be a bit more level-headed maybe in certain moments, and just be definitely a sort of a good, almost like a sage type character, like Dumbledore is in a way, but just more from a student level. But obviously Cedric is in an older year level, and maybe that would be a little bit different if Cedric was the same year as Harry, and got kind of caught up in all his classes and all these other things. But for the most part, I feel like Cedric's, he's a pretty good dude. So it Rowling sets him up as like this character that it is really unfortunate that this is the guy that, spoiler alert, you know, dies. So it's rough.
Blake, I know you hinted at it earlier, and I don't know if you were thinking this was a big thing for the whole chapter or just for Harry, but I think one of the things in this chapter that is something that brings the Hagrid story and the Harry story together is this idea of pride. It's one of those things that, you know, obviously we see it with Harry refusing to listen to Cedric's advice. But, you know, the other thing that we really see is that Hagrid, I think, is in some ways more upset that people know his history than he is about his history itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. He's not ashamed of who he is, but he's almost like looking at what, I don't know, what others think of him because it's now out there.
Exactly.
So it's not, he's not ashamed of who he is and who his mom is, who his dad is, like, but more so what others think of him. And so I think those two things are different.
Yeah. And so that's one of the things that Dumbledore really has a great word on is that, you know, Hagrid, if you wait for perfect approval rating, you'll never teach a day in your life at Hogwarts.
Exactly.
You could probably say any school. It would be certainly true as well. Yeah, there's just no way you can expect that of yourself, expect that of anything else. Yeah.
This is a great chapter looking at, as us as teachers, and that all, you know, it's quite a kind of a helpful chapter in that it teaches us a little bit, within that. And I do love that interaction between, Harry, Ron and Hermione and Dumbledore. I love that scene where, you know, they're banging down the door essentially and then opened it up and it's, oh, it's actually Dumbledore. Well, this, I didn't know. I didn't mean, and they're like, you'd be like a bit sort of stunned in the presence of like the headmaster just at Hagrid's hut, where you kind of, everything's pretty casual. But as soon as like they come face to face with the headmaster there, it's like it changes everything. But it's a really nice, warming interaction because Dumbledore kind of is down there. It's not like he's summoned Hagrid up to his office. It's like he's going to where Hagrid is. He's meeting him where he is, and like just being like trying to convince him, and then Harry, Ron, and Hermione come at the right time, and Dumbledore uses that to kind of I don't know if the nail in the coffin is the right word in this regard or the phrasing in this, but like essentially to seal the deal. Dumbledore uses them as that final kind of like, you're being silly, I expect your return, see you for breakfast, you know. So it's pretty
good. And I think it's another really good example, like, of how well Dumbledore knows his staff, right? Like, compare how he treats Hagrid to how he treats Professor Trelawney. Like, both he treats with kindness, but both he really treats them uniquely and personally. And while he's quite firm with Hagrid and says, Hagrid, you're being ridiculous, he also is quite understanding of Trelawney's, you know, sensitivity and things like that. You go
and
for
speaking
it.
Of yeah. Hagrid, right? You know, we mentioned obviously that great interaction with Dumbledore and in our trio, but you know, hearing that little bit of fact of like, you know, his dad dying before he actually got expelled, and like little bits and pieces, like this is a real kind of an opening that we see into Hagrid's life. And he's in, you know, and I kind of put this down as like almost like sinking depression, and it might not be this bad, you know, but like it's more just that like Hagrid is going through a real rough deal, you know. And you know, he's thinking everybody's gonna almost like judge him for being a giant and be like, you know, a monster, and people think like, you know, oh man, everybody's gonna look at me and think I'm a monster. And and that's ruthless. But I love all the little bits of encouragement throughout that Dumbledore says, you know, like the amount of people that wrote back to Dumbledore saying that they would have something to say about it if, you know, Dumbledore sacked Hagrid, and you know, you can't seek universal approval or acceptance. Yeah, so we see a little bit more into Hagrid. I think we sort of soften up to how Hagrid's feeling, and he's not just a giant with sort of hard giant emotions. Like he's a, you know, he's a feeling guy.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Blake, that, you know, one of the things to, in Hagrid's defense, not saying what he's feeling is right, but why it's understandable, is that he's kind of been through this once before as a student, you know, being kicked out of Hogwarts. And it's something that he definitely will have to fight again later when Dolores Umbridge comes. Like, as much as Dumbledore doesn't want him to be thinking in this way, it's like there's a reason why he's affected by this. Is he knows what it's like to be I guess unfairly treated, to be have prejudices against him, and it's not unfounded, even though it's unfounded when it comes to Dumbledore.
Yeah. And so we mentioned, obviously, Professor Grubbly Plank, you know, and her as a substitute teacher. And so I feel like she must be just chilling in the village or something. You know, there is magic transportation, obviously. But, yeah, definitely, she's got to be somewhere almost close. But it's nice that she's stepping up, and a bit awkward that she kind of does seem like she's the better teacher, as a lot of students are enjoying her lesson, which obviously that annoys kind of Harry a lot, because he's thinking of Hagrid, and Hermione's pretty pumped, and like it was a bit, you know, she's like, oh, I didn't even know those things, and I'm like, really?
Hermione just loves learning.
Surely you would know everything, but she still doesn't. She's still a student. She's still learning, and there's always a place for a teacher, even with someone who is incredibly smart.
Yeah, well, I love how Harry just feels betrayed when Hermione says something very, very modest, very straightforward. Like, Harry just takes it so personally. It's great.
Yeah. Anything more to say about?
No, we'll save our Grubbly Plank deep dive for Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix.
Perfect. And then Ludo Bagman, so he tries to cheat again, and we you know, giving help Harry those helpful tips and being like, can I help you? And it's like, you know, that awkward like, have you tried Cedric? And it's like, oh well, you know, you're the underdog, Harry, you're the one we really like, you know, he's trying to, I guess, get in, and we still sort of don't fully understand why he's doing this. And but you know, it's obviously alongside all these little comments of like, oh, you know, Rita Skeeter, I can tell you things about Ludo Bagman, you know, and we're kind of tricked into thinking that maybe he's this bad guy, and he's being set up as that sort of red herring. But he slips the Weasleys, and I love that whole plot of him kind of avoiding the Weasley twins, because it's only on that second or third read through that you actually, you know, make that connection, like, oh, that's right, he, you know, they owe him money. And and it's kind of like I lost that, at least in my first read through. I didn't really kind of connect those two things, but we see a little bit more about Ludo Bagman this chapter too.
Yeah, right. It's a plot line that's completely missing from the movie, right? And And I mean, not just the plot line, it's a character that's missing from the movie as well. And so this theme, which is pretty important, especially if, you know, as we're thinking about the fact that he keeps avoiding Fred and George, he's trying to help Harry cheat. Winky says he's a bad man. All these things kind of keep coming up again and again. And we're supposed to be thinking, are we really supposed to doubt all these different streams of witnesses who keep saying the same thing about Ludo?
Yeah, exactly. Who do we trust, right? Who do we trust? Do we personally think, when we're reading through these, do we think, yeah, is Ludo a good guy? Is Ludo a bad guy? You know, he seems like a fun person, but it's a bit confusing.
It is a bit confusing, Blake. And as we'll come to see in the next book, it's a bit confusing because of Ludo Bagman's pretty high status as a celebrity within the wizarding world. You know, it's not like he was just your average run-of-the-mill. Is there I'm trying to think of, I was going to say something like Quidditcher, like a cricketer or footballer, but I don't think that's a word. Quidditch player. He was famous. You know, he played for England.
Yeah, I know. Like it's not like he's some amateur. Like he is, like he's a big deal in a way, you know, I feel like he's a big deal. And I think he knows he's a big deal. Not so much.
Oh, does he ever?
He doesn't have that same like craziness as, you know, Gilderoy Lockhart of like, I'm a big deal, because like he wasn't a big deal kind of thing, because he sort of lied his way to the top. Whereas like Ludo's actually like, oh no, he's one of these popular people that then got into politics, I guess, after, you know, they were doing, you know, their sports and things like that. And that's quite a common story, where you switch from high performance sport or whatever, and then you jump over to, because you're that sort of public figure anyway, you jump into politics or something. So he jumped into this sort of ministry job here. But looking at what we see with world building and anything new that we see, we actually kind of see with the blast-ended scroots, they're made up of like two creatures from breeding, manticores and fire crabs, which they were just sort of thrown in there. And unicorns, obviously, we get a little bit of information about that. But I think we get a little bit more in the following chapters when we talk about they do more stuff with the unicorn.
We found out about the unicorn foals, don't we?
Oh, that's right. Hagrid takes back over that, which is pretty great. That they start out gold. We can talk about that next time. But it's very interesting. I never really had heard of that aspect of it. And I wonder if that's original to what, you know, Rowling did, or if that's just part of general.
We'll feature some unicorn mythology maybe next time that comes up. We'll
exactly
look at it. So, it's interesting where some of these magical creatures definitely have their origin in other forms of mythology, whereas some are pretty unique. So we'll point out that.
One of the things that I love is that, you know, this whole series of the Harry Potter books is nothing like, you know, say Lord of the Rings, where the language that is created for these, you know, mythical creatures and characters and all that sort of stuff are like real, I guess, I don't know, there's just more to Lord of the Rings with the other languages, whereas we don't get a whole lot. And one language that does come up, and this is from Ludo Bagman, but is a gobbledygook, which is, you know, language between goblins, and it's bloodfuck, and it means pickaxe. And so, you know, we don't get a whole lot, because I think that bogs down readers, especially the young readers that she's writing to, like if there was so much language stuff like in Lord of the Rings. But it's pretty fun there that we get a little bit of extra language.
I don't know. I put gobbledygook up against Tolkien's elvish language any day of the week.
True. Yeah. Who am I kidding? Gobbledygook is just legendary. So let's all grab our blood vac and go to the mines.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the last questions to pose is that do lawyers exist in the wizarding world, Josh? Because I kind of want to know, does Hagrid have like a defamation suit against, you know, Rita Skeeter for this type of thing? I'm not too sure if that's an issue, but yeah, I just haven't seen lawyers.
I don't think we actually see them. We do hear them mentioned by Rufus Scrimgeour in the Deathly Hallows, where he comes to read Dumbledore's will to Harry, Ron, and Hermione. He mentions that Hermione might have a career in wizard law, and she makes the hilarious joke that seems to be maybe a muggle joke or maybe a wizard joke, that she actually wants to do some good with her life. So I'm not sure if wizards hate lawyers and muggles hate lawyers or what it is, but
yeah,
there's definitely, you know, some of that stereotype going on. But one of the things that I think is interesting, Blake, is that this is a pretty common thing in the UK when it comes to like tabloids, like defamation, libel. These suits are very frequent in the UK because tabloids just have a, I don't know, a pretty crazy presence in history in the UK.
Yeah. I don't think there's like I haven't seen at least as many crazy tabloid type things come out of like the States compared to the UK. Like there's almost like so much going on where it's like they're almost like investigative kind of journalists, but in a nasty way.
Yes.
And it's crazy the amount that they dig into someone's life and try and get that photo, trying to get that expose on this person. And it just seems a bit crazy. So it's really like Reed Skeet is almost like the embodiment of all those things. And her coming against Hagrid like this is very much in that same fashion as those tabloids and just trying to get that. You essentially just needed like Hagrid, you know, like one sort of exposing photo of Hagrid like doing something gianty or like talking with a giant in the back.
That's
alley,
right. Picking up like two children on his shoulders or something. I don't know.
Yeah, something that like only a giant does. And it's like that would be the nail in the coffin there. But so we get that and we see that aspect of the world and the wizarding world. But yeah, lawyers, that may be not a profession that we'll jump into. Seems like policymakers and lawmakers, it's like, is that as interesting as fighting dragons or, you know, dealing with being an aura and things like that? That seems way cooler. So,
well, speaking of Rita Skeeter, we do get a bit of foreshadowing. This has been a couple chapters in a row, like, if I'm not mistaken, about how it's going to kind of come out. And so we've heard about her being beetle-like. And then this chapter, we get a quote saying, you know, this is the exact sort of thing she'd do, hide in the bushes and listen to people, which is how Skeeter got her incriminating evidence against Hagrid.
I love it. That's exactly what she was doing. Definitely something that you kind of think like it's just so ever so slight, but they do sort of put it throughout. And because it's so subtle, you know, that it can be in multiple chapters where there's like bits and pieces that sort of lead to that bit. So, yeah, that's great. But obviously, if we look at this chapter as a whole, Josh, you know, we see that, you know, Hagrid, who has been quite defeated by all of this, the trio once again stick by his side and, you know, essentially just come to his defense. And who cares about who his family is? That doesn't matter to them. You know, we know you, Hagrid. You're amazing. And, you know, and then Dumbledore, stop being silly. You'll be at work. I'll see you for breakfast, 8:30 or Monday or whatever. And so that's great. But then, you know, also Harry finally being resolved to actually use Cedric's clue about the egg.
Yeah, big humility move by Harry on this one.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. To support the podcast and keep the magic alive, you can leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also support us financially at www.buymeacoffee.com/muffleadopod. And to send us questions on our Instagram, email, or website, do so at muffleadopodcast.com. To continue the adventure, join us next time as we discuss the 25th chapter of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, The Egg in the Eye.